FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt is at his best when he's off script. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. There were some aviation industry organizations which apparently didn't consider this month's Pilot Training Reform Symposium important enough to justify sending high-level executives. The FAA was not one of those organizations. In addition to sending key mid-level management to the event May 4th and 5th in Atlanta, FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt himself made it for the final day, in time to hear the recommendations reported back from the breakout sessions. Babbitt also offered a keynote speech, and he's as good as anyone at doing that. But during a question and answer session which followed, he showed that we can often learn more about the things that really matter when we can get regulatory officials to speak frankly and off script. In two parts, today and tomorrow, we'll hear that Q&A.
I'll try to meet you halfway. If you have questions, I'll try to have answers. Sometimes it doesn't work that way.
Administrator, you mentioned the new experimental transition AC that came out. Are you aware of the work that EAA has done to create the waiver so that people can actually train in an experimental airplane? You might not know that a lot of your FISDOs are not aware of it, and it's not easy to get, which makes it hard to take that AC and put it into practice. Is there a way to change that or get that information where the FISDOs can understand it and actually issue those letters of waiver?
Yeah. Many of your students, they do a great job. You teach them to fly. They're very comfortable. They're cautious. They do all the right things. And they fly very stable training aircraft. And they get comfortable, and they decide it's time to move up. And they go out, and maybe they've got an experimental aircraft, a home built or something. Oftentimes, these are very high-performance airplanes, and it's a big step. The wing loading is higher, a lot of changes. They're complex airplanes in some cases. And so we see, and I don't know whether we've had any of our statistics shown here, but we watch a fairly dramatic rise, not unlike a bell curve, where they're in the early parts of it. I'm getting it now, and now I'm real comfortable. I got 20 hours in the airplane, I'm really comfortable, and I'm as good as I was in my 150. But the problem is the airplane has a lot of characteristics that are not nearly as forgiving, and that's where the problems begin. And so the accident rates soar through that period. That's what the AC is focused on, and we can certainly look at, you know, the waivers and how to make sure that people get that training, because that's the key to it. Make sure they understand what they're transitioning to.
My name is Alan Engelhart. I mentioned that I was a member of ALPA for 37 years with United Airlines. And I have a son who's 20 years old. He's an engineering student at University of Illinois. He's also a flight instructor for the university. Like many young people his age, he has an interest in being an airline pilot. Of course, what I'm asking about is the new Part 121 requirement mandated by Congress that all first officers have an ATP. Of course, with less and less flight instructing abilities, because there's just so much less going on, it would be almost impossible for him to accumulate 1,500 hours in any reasonable amount of time. I've heard that the FAA, the administrator, is aware of this problem and is working on solutions for higher level training that would allow people to qualify with less than 1,500 hours. Could you discuss that a little bit, please?
Yeah, I have to be somewhat guarded in my discussion simply because the rule is at a point where the comment period is closed and the final rule is an out. But I can tell you, and I think if you look back on some of the testimony I had, before Congress made that mandate, I had actually started, I'd only been at the FAA 2 months, and I had a new advanced notice of proposed rulemaking, which said we ought to take a look. And I wasn't focused so much on flight time. I was focused on the training that someone had, the credentials that they actually had, because, and I believe I said in testimony, I don't accept that total time is a proxy for real experience. People make the assumption that if you have 1,500 hours, then clearly you know all about icing, you know all about high altitude flying, you know all about cockpit resource management, but the reality is you don't. You may not, you may, but you may not. And that was my focus. I wanted to make certain, I didn't make training the proxy. I gave an example, and if I had pretty strong feelings, and I still have them, about some of the criteria, and my opposition to that, in terms of just, you know, ATP and 1,500 hours, and that's what it needs to be, I indicated to Congress that I had concerns about that because it wasn't a guarantee that you were qualified, and I think we can do better. And one of the examples I used was Air Florida. I was based in Washington at the time. I was in the airplane that landed behind that airplane, so I know what the weather conditions were. The first officer on that airplane had 7,000 hours. He's a very well-trained pilot. He flew in the Air Force, and he was very well-trained. He had an ATP and 7,000 hours. He had never seen snow fall on an airplane. He was not equipped for the mission. A good pilot. There's nothing wrong. I have no qualms about his credentials as a pilot. My qualm was with our system that said he was qualified to fly in all weather, and he wasn't. He had what would appear to be very substantial qualifications, but they weren't the qualifications that I would much rather have had a pilot who had 750 hours, had been trained in icing holdover conditions and you know, the effects of icing on a jet engine and so forth. So that's where the breakover is. So what you're seeing now, I think what you're going to, you know, see some focus. Yes, one answer would be to have an ATP, and that would be nice. Or you could have less time and show that you had had the academic training in these various areas. Also, the military. We have a lot of pilots. There was a very notable editorial the pilot wrote, and he was very defensive of me, so I appreciated him. That doesn't happen often. I really treasure an editorial that starts off with "Babbitt has it right." You know, I have it framed at home. It's the only one I have. So. But his point was, he said, you know, I've got almost 800 hours. I'm qualified in single and multi-engine, one piston, two jets. I've flown carry landings. I've defended this country in two different war theaters. And somebody thinks I ought to go out and get another 700 hours before I can fly for an airline. We're wrong-headed there. This is a very well-qualified pilot. And so that's what our focus is, and I think you know, I'd have pretty good concurrence in this room that if we train and we know we have given somebody the experience, that's a far better feeling than knowing that they just got a lot of time and we assume they got that experience. So that's where that regulation is headed, in a very long-winded answer.
More of Randy Babbitt's Q&A in a moment. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Diamond Aircraft's new DA-40 Diamond Star XL includes all popular Diamond options, combined with the sensational new Garmin GFC-700 Autopilot, a higher performance power plant, and increased gross weight. This makes the Diamond Star XL the perfect choice for affordable personal flying. The Diamond Star XL features equipment and enhancements that increase performance, capability, safety, convenience, and comfort. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3020.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. We're listening to FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt taking questions at the recent Pilot Training Reform Symposium in Atlanta. The next question comes from the former head of the FAA's Commercial and General Aviation Division, Robert Wright.
Mr. Administrator, having previously been in Mel's job before your watch, I know that I watch what goes on inside the Beltway a lot, and I know that you may get a budget soon for fiscal year 2010, but your resources in the future, it's very uncertain. Mm-hmm. And I look back at the past safety efforts like CAST, enormously successful, Commercial mm-hmm. Aviation Safety Team. Is there some way that you can ensure that when the time comes for us to put a program forward where perhaps the Joint Safety Committee, the GA equivalent of the CAS, will have sufficient funding to work some of the safety issues that we identify?
Well, I wish I could say without, you know, equivocation that, yes, I can assure that. Unfortunately, you know, the budget that we have put forward, the President's budget, there's some variance between that budget and what specifically the House has put forward. We really are only involved in, you know, I mean, you could literally took off the catalog of things. I mean, clearly safety is our number one priority, and we're not going to put safety behind anything. So safety, we will cover the safety mandate, and we will do it properly. But if you said, well, we're going to cut you know, 8% of your budget, or, you know, some massive amount, or 6%, or whatever the number is, and I guarantee you I'm not putting safety in the backseat to anything, then what do we do with the other programs? So now I'm forced to prioritize, and I have said it privately, I've said it publicly. I am concerned that if you reduce these funding levels far enough, we're on the edge of degrading our ability to maintain the world's safest aviation system. We're on the edge of choking certification of new products. We have a finite number of people, and if we furlough several thousand of them, then we're not going to be able to bring new products to market. Somebody builds a new wingtip. Somebody builds a new composite to replace something on the aircraft. Somebody designs new technology. We have to certify those things. We certify 2,200 things a year at the FAA. All of these are innovations, the things that not only do they make aviation safer, better, and so forth, and nowadays a lot of focus on efficiency. Not only do they do that, but they typically come from companies who are going to hire a bunch of people to build them. So, I mean, so I'm faced with the Sophie's choice of, we've got three people that want to build factories on the East Coast of the United States, Boeing, Honda Jet, and Embraer, and for lack of certification inspectors to start up a plant, I delay a plant opening that's going to employ 4,000 people for 6 months. That's not, to me, that's not thoughtful use of our taxpayer dollars. It's just not. So I am concerned about, you know, having the money to do these things, and I think we gave them a very thoughtful budget. It's a very reasonable budget, less than the cost of inflation when you look at it year over year. We found a lot of ways to save money. We're going to find a lot of ways in the future to save even more money. So I am concerned that, you know, I'm all for being frugal. I want to be a good steward of the taxpayer dollar. But I don't want to threaten, you know, this system and the innovation that comes from supporting programs like you talk about.
Tomorrow, FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt addresses professionalism, next gen, and outdated regulations. The FAA website is www.faa.gov. You can find out more about the Pilot Training Reform Symposium and read the reports as they're finalized at pilottrainingreform.org. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.